Hello and what is up, everybody? Welcome to the Wind Up Podcast. I am your host, Mike of MTGA Wines, and we got our end of the month Q&A episode. The month of May is wrapping up officially. We have answers to your questions. We got some fun ones to dive into, everything from production and second labels to blending options, larger producers doing great things. We got a lot of stuff to cover in today's Q&A episode. Before we get into it, as usual, just a couple of quick announcements. Be sure to like, subscribe to the show here. We appreciate you so much for doing so. Wherever you're consuming the podcast, if you can leave a little rating or review, that is hugely helpful in making it searchable and findable for wine lovers out and about around the country or around the world even. Be sure to follow us on all of our social networks. That's at MTGA Wines. We're most active on YouTube, Instagram. You can also find us on the Book of Face, the social network formerly known as Twitter, to kind of keep up with the normal happenings. Particularly on YouTube and Instagram, we post a whole lot of videos and content just kind of diving into wine production, what's actually going on in the vineyards, in the cellar, plus a few lovely little photos and videos and things that you can live vicariously through when you just need to see a good view from Napa on a particularly random afternoon wherever you might be. Be sure to head to our websites, mtgawines.com or blairpaytonwines.com. You can find a little bit more information on all the wines that the HBIC and I produce under our respective labels. On MTGA Wines in particular, if you scroll down on that homepage a little ways, you can find a little email box towards the bottom where you can submit questions to our Q&A episodes that we do at the end of every month. I try and compile kind of the most popular themes of what folks are asking, whether it's here in Napa in the cellar as we're doing wine tastings, or if it's just stuff that's submitted through our DMs or through that little email box on our website. We try and cover as much as we can, so be sure to submit those. All right, I think that does it. Not a lot going on announcement-wise, I think. We're just going to dive right into the main event, which will be question number one. Yeah. This is coming off the heels, and we've got a few questions that we're going to kind of start with or kind of in the middle that are going to focus on a couple of the last episodes that we've done as far as like good producers and higher quality wine and getting more people into it. We're going to start, though, on kind of blending and kind of the starting point for that. Because this is a great kind of basic winemaking question that we get all the time. And it is, when blending, how do you distinguish, say, a normal Cabernet Sauvignon, for example, versus the reserve bottling? And this goes towards things like our single barrel Merlot that we produce. You could say this is, you know, if you take a larger producer, like say Opus One out here, you have Opus One and then you have kind of their second label, Overture, you know, and there you kind of have this yin and yang of different Cabernets or blends produced by a single producer, right? Now, when it comes to blending, you know, you're always kind of relying on your house style. If you haven't heard that term before, it's basically what that winery is known for. Kind of stylistically, are they more fruity, kind of jammy, really big and intense wines? Are they really lean, kind of structured and intense, you know, and kind of rough around the edges wines that need some aging? Is it something in between? Is it more reds? Is it more whites? Is it more blends? Is it more single variety, like single vineyard wines? You know, over the course of many, many years as a wine producer, you start kind of dialing that in and what you're going to be known for. So, for example, for us in MTGA, you have our Merlot. Merlot is what we started with. We've made 100% single vineyard Merlots for a long, long time. And that's something that we are very much known for. So we kind of have this house style that's been built around that particular wine, which is, you know, more acid driven, a little bit more refreshing, and hopefully very ageable reds in particular, but even some white wines as well. So once you kind of have that framework that you're working off of, you start trying to figure out, okay, what separates like the good lots or like the good barrels from the great barrels or maybe the not so good barrels. And quite frankly, this just comes with time and experience. If you haven't been making wine previously, if you don't work, you know, full time in this industry, blending wine, making wine, you're not necessarily going to be able to pick out these differences in barrel. Because you also have to think of it this way, that when you're tasting a specific barrel, let's say I go out there, I pull out a wine thief and I pull some wine out of a barrel and take a sip of it, I'm tasting what is potentially a small percentage of kind of an overall blend, right? So using our Merlot again as an example, that Merlot might be like 8 or 10 different barrels. If I taste one of those barrels, it's only going to be a small percentage of what that wine is going to end up being. Because if you're using multiple barrels and blending them all together, you're going to have all kinds of subtle differences from one to the next. Even if those grapes are the same grapes, the same variety, coming from the same vineyard, produced in essence the same way, the fact that they're in these separate containers can create these very subtle differences. You know, one barrel might be really fruity and like plush. Another one might be really structured and rough around the edges. One might be like a good blend between those two things. Another barrel might be new oak. Another barrel might be used once or twice or three or four times even. So you create all these very small, subtle lots, especially for us small producers. Now, larger producers will kind of do the same thing. They kind of know, you know, what sections of what vineyards do really, really well. They also know what barrels they typically like for certain wines, certain aging time, things of that nature. And it's just done at a little bit of a larger scale, where you're blending kind of those larger lots together earlier on in the process as you're doing rackings and things of that nature, versus kind of keeping these more like single, all these individual like single barrel lots like set aside, right? Does that make sense? So when it comes time for blending, which is what we're kind of working on right now for our 2023 reds, and I'm having a hell of a time with our Cabernet actually, as well as our red blend right now. All good things, they're gonna get there, but you know, they've been challenging to kind of put together over the last couple of weeks. Is we'll sit down or we'll start tasting through the barrels that we want to use for a particular wine, right? The trick is for like a larger producer is you might only be able to take like a random sample. You might, if you've got 10,000 barrels in your barrel cellar, if you're using barrels to begin with and not just, you know, oak chips or and storing everything in stainless or whatever the case may be, you know, you might not be able to taste every individual barrel. You're probably going to have to take either a random sample or bring all those barrels up to tank and kind of have like these larger, you know, kind of condense these lots down so it's not quite as overwhelming. You know, there's a little room for everybody. You can definitely find photos of people, you know, with a blending table with like a couple hundred glasses on there that they have to like sort through like what barrel's going where. That's something we try and avoid by, you know, just tasting through our barrels regularly throughout the year and making sure like, hey, I already have a pretty good idea of what barrel's gonna go where. It's just a matter of making some fine tuning like adjustments when we get, you know, a few weeks or a month or so before bottling, right? So how do you decide? Like what makes that just like normal wine versus the reserve wine, so to speak, right? And this is where it can be a little subjective and you can really start splitting hairs. But the general idea is that when you're bottling up that reserve wine, it's more complex, it's more interesting, it's more complete, it's yummier. It has an X factor that kind of takes it a notch above where kind of the normal bottling would be. It is also, again, kind of, you have to base it off of, you know, what you've done historically. So if you've made this wine before, then you have like this pedigree that you can work off of. Now, if you're bottling this wine for the first time, you're like, okay, well, we really need to like hit this the right way. Otherwise, you know, if this is not good enough and it's too close to kind of the normal bottling, but we're charging, let's say, twice the price, like it's just not going to make sense. In that same light, right, these reserve wines are typically more expensive because they're typically limited in production. We view them as higher quality and we're bottling them separately. And to make smaller lots of wine is just more expensive. Kind of the smaller and smaller you get, the more expensive it gets. So with that, you're like, okay, this has to kind of live up to this price point. Like we can't just say, hey, we're going to charge $250 for this because our normal cab is $125. Plenty of people actually do that. But hopefully on the back end of it, it's like, hey, this wine we believe is objectively like twice as good. Hopefully, right? That's the goal. So when it comes to setting aside these reserve wines, you know, that's kind of the criteria. Like how much more complete is this wine than the other wine that we'd be making from these like same grapes, Now, there's a caveat to all this, right? And that is once we, the consumers, try, or you, the consumers, try these wines back home. Because you might buy, this happens to us all the time, actually, is that there are plenty, and it happens to every producer, there are plenty of wines out there that are kind of like the other wine, they're not the reserve bottling, that I love. And the reserve bottling's like solid, and I'm like, I like it, but I really love the other thing. And that's just something that can, you know, that's just something that that happens. It can be subjective based on just what you, the consumer, enjoy, right? So even though it's a reserve wine, quote unquote, it doesn't necessarily make it objectively better. It's always the beauty is the eye and the beholder with wine. You may love it more, you may not. You know, that's just kind of the way it goes. You know, every wine producer will try and produce kind of that reserve bottling to be the best interpretation of what they can produce year in and year out. Whether or not that actually hits a home run with you is a completely different conversation. Some years you might absolutely love, and then some years you'd be like, you know what? I really love like the normal bottling of this. It just has a little more something going on. It can ebb and flow. You know, this is something we talk about a lot on the show, is that there's not really like this objective nature to wine, right? You as an individual just have to figure out what you like, what you personally enjoy. And sometimes that might be the reserve bottling. Sometimes that might be the cheaper and cheerful version of it, right? So I'll use one of our family wines as a great example, because, you know, for what my grandfather made, my dad's been making under the Con Valley, Anderson's Con Valley label forever, the Right Bank wine has been my favorite. It's that Right Bank, you know, Merlot, Cab Franc blend. And it's always lights out. It's my favorite wine. It's been forever my favorite wine since they started making it in the early 2000s. You know, I know that the Alloge and even the Estate Cab get a lot of praise, or if you go kind of up the food chain between like the Signature Cabernet or the Orem or the Gustav, some of these other blends they do, like they're really delicious. But even though they're the smaller, kind of higher end, more quote unquote, like complex, interesting offerings, I still just love the Right Bank. Like it is just like my thing. You know, the same thing could go for, say, even a, I'll shout out friends of ours up at Barnett Vineyards, because I love everything that they do. And their Rattlesnake Cabernet is kind of their top of the top, some of the best wine they make every year. But I'll tell you what, like their Spring Mountain Cab, as good as Rattlesnake is, that Spring Mountain Cab, as far as like bang for your buck goes, is like outrageously delicious, right? So it's not that I like don't like some of the quote like reserve bottling, so to speak. It's just like sometimes the other one just has like the leg up for whatever reason. And it's just my own personal tastes. Actually, I mentioned Opus 1. Like the normal Opus 1 bottling, like I haven't been the biggest fan of lately, and I've enjoyed Overture for what it is. So, you know, like that can be a thing too. You have to kind of figure it out on your own. But when it comes to us, the producer, kind of the general theme is when we're putting these wines together, is we are truly trying to find kind of the wines that we would consider to be higher quality. And again, it can be splitting hairs here. For us, it's a big deal because we are, you know, uber dialed into, you know, what we are experiencing with these wines, because we've been working on them for years in some situations. And we truly believe that, like, hey, this is the better wine. And we can tell that to you, the consumer, and you are more than welcome to disagree with us. And that does happen because, again, it is a little bit subjective, right? But the idea always is going to be when you're blending kind of the normal wine versus the reserve bottling, the reserve is going to be that more complex, have more of an X factor, just yummier, like all around kind of hits you, you know, it hits you the right way. Where the normal one's like a little bit more like, okay, like this is very everyday kind of style, you know, like you can open this up without like having to think too hard about it. It's kind of that guilt-free bottling, right? That you can, you know, open up when you're, you know, having guests over, you're four bottles in already, and you're like, yeah, we can open up this fifth one because it's the normal one. It's not that big of a deal. We're going to save the reserve for the next time we all hang out, and we'll open up that first next time so we can all really enjoy it, right? You kind of tier it out. So there's some strategy to how we're producing these wines and kind of the expectation of how they're being like utilized by you guys when you're drinking them, in that the reserve bottlings are kind of those special occasion. It's the first bottle of the night. It's something that you really kind of pay a little bit more attention to and enjoy right out of the gate. And then when you get to the more normal wines, maybe that's your Tuesday night pizza wine. Maybe that's you're carrying on late into the evening. You need another bottle of wine. So you open up the one that's kind of the lower tier, so to speak, so that you don't feel bad about opening up like the really expensive bottle when you're already kind of tying one on. So that can be part of it as well. It's fun. It can be really tough to create some of these wines because you are splitting hairs sometimes with some of these flavors and characteristics. And other times you're tasting through your barrels and your blends, you're like, oh, this is just lights out, like better, more complete, more complex, more interesting. This is it. That's how our single barrel program started, how our Cab Franc program started. It was like, oh, these barrels are just objectively just solid. And we need to cut these from the herd. They do not deserve to be blended with anything else. All righty. Let's dive into question number two, shall we? So this was posed. Actually, we got an email yesterday, I believe. Big shout out to Mike out in the Carolinas. Always jumping in and saying, hey. Had a couple of questions in regards to a couple of the last episodes. We're going to dive into those two next. And I kind of distilled them down a little bit here, but we'll be able to really kind of hit the question in a good way. And it really centered around kind of getting regular, more people into wine or introduced to wine and drinking kind of higher quality wines in particular, with the challenge of like Napa specifically being it's really tough to offer, like affordable wines out the gate, right? You're typically going to be paying a little bit of a premium because of just the expense of this place and the small production of it and yada, 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 all that stuff. So this question, what large producers are doing it right in terms of offering good quality? Because I think that's kind of what the direction that we are going here. And I have like one great example. Let me go ahead and bring this up just so I can kind of reference what you said, Mike, a little bit easier here. Because, that's the tough thing, and I think, Mike, you mentioned that, when you're talking about France, Italy, other European countries, when they've been doing this for centuries in some cases, when you have a little bit more support in terms of how the wine industry is subsidized in some of these countries by the government, it's a little bit easier to make more approachable, higher quality wines at a larger scale because you know more. You're also contending with a consumer base that has grown up in and around fine wine their entire lives, where the U.S., that's not a thing. We are just now getting into, generations of people where their family has been drinking wine for like generations. Like that's just starting for us. Even though, some people, way back in the, before wine was getting popular in California in particular, again, you go back to the 60s when Robert Mondavi was just getting here. And before that, you had the late 1800s, but of course you had Prohibition that blew it up. It's tough. It's just really, really tough. Now, when it comes to like offering good quality as a large producer, it's very doable, but we do contend with the fact that here in the United States, people have a sweet tooth. So you have a lot, and I mean a lot of brands and companies that are offering wines that are typically on the sweeter side. And I do want to say there is kind of there's always this notion that kind of these sweeter, flabbier, I think, wines are of lower quality. And I don't necessarily like agree with that. I don't necessarily disagree with it. I think it's a cheat code to try and sell as many bottles as you possibly can because these wines are very sexy. They're very approachable. It's just enough sugar that they're not like a dessert wine per se, but they're just like the acidity is not there. It's not too tart. The tannins are softer. Like it's manufactured in a way to be really, really yummy. A lot like pick your favorite fast food restaurant is manufactured in a way to be like really, really yummy. So I think, and this is just me kind of like maybe reading the tea leaves or shaking my, magic eight ball a little too hard here, is that you just don't have this is going to sound a little bad maybe, but you just don't have the consumer buy-in for high quality wine here in the US like you do in Europe, period, right? And that's something that we need to work on kind of to this point. So as far as like larger producers like offering like better quality, one that I think is starting to get there is through someone I grew up with, and that's Josh Phelps and Grounded Wine Company. We had a bottle of his Space Age Rosé down at Cadet Wine and Beer Bar in Napa over the weekend during some of the bottle rock festivities. And he's making wines that, you know, are California wines, Paso Robles wines, a little bit of Oregon, a little bit of Napa. And as far as I'm concerned, like doing some pretty good stuff. You know, is this going to be like your next favorite like cult wine that's going to knock your socks off? No, but that's not the goal of the brands. It's to make these, you know, more affordable, approachable, just solid wines. Are you going to, you know, write home about them and extol the virtues of them? Maybe, maybe not, depending on how much you love it. But, you know, he's doing a good job of trying to offer, I think, good quality and good value for what is lower price point wines. I haven't run the labs on any of those, so I have no idea if he's doing, you know, a little bit of residual in some of these things based on how the, by residual, I mean residual sugar. You know, I'm probably not going to either because I know the guy, I've tried the wines, I enjoy them. That's good enough for me, right? So, you know, I think that that's kind of the trend that needs to happen. You have brand, you don't really have a lot of people trying to do that, it seems like. You know, you definitely had, you know, maybe what Dave Finney did back in the day, you know, when The Prisoner was, you know, kind of just that red blend that was around like 30, 40 bucks. Like, it's just a shadow of what, it, you know, how many times it's changed hands and how much the production has changed on it, how expensive it is now. Compared to what it was, you know, back in the day, The Prisoner was a very solid, like, everyday red blend. And of course, that has just changed quite a bit. So, you know, I don't know if I have a real, like, answer for this. Like, how do we find better quality and what large producers are doing it right in terms of good quality? You kind of have to shop around and just see if you can find them. And unfortunately, they're just few and far between. Actually, we got into it regarding The Prisoner in particular. Of course, I believe that's owned by Constellation Brands these days. So, you know, it is what it is. But we were having brunch on Monday. We were talking about it. And I'm like, yeah, it's just, you know, from what it was to what it is now, it's just so much sweeter. And it's just not what I think like an introductory, like high quality wine should be for people. And good on a colleague and a very good friend of mine who works for the Napa Vintners was like, yeah, but it is a great introductory wine that gets more people drinking wine that might not be drinking wine otherwise. My only bone to pick with that is that it is somewhere between like, I think 50 and like 80 bucks a bottle. So like what person that's new to wine is going to spend, you know, let's call it $65 to $70 on that bottle of wine to get into wine, right? You need something at a lower price point that is higher quality, not the, you know, hey, this is your low calorie wine because there's only a couple of grams or a few grams of sugar in it now. It's like, oh no, we can actually make technically dry, well-made wines from, you know, pick an appellation and let's do that. Now, is it going to be really tough for a large producer to do the right thing in terms of quality and like say, hey, we're going to produce a Napa wine at this low price point? Yeah, that's damn near impossible because of just the expense of doing business here, the fruit, the production, everything. So this might not be what Napa can do in terms of picking up the charge and saying, hey, we're going to start making these really approachable, you know, more cost or lower cost wines. It's just, we can't do it because it's too expensive. Can you go to a place like the Central Valley of California, Paso Robles, certain parts of Oregon, Washington? Yeah, you absolutely can. And there's opportunity there to start making really great high quality, albeit, you know, high quality for the price point, right? Wines. I think this is very possible. And frankly, just based on what the average consumer in the US likes to drink, there's a large swath of people that just aren't doing that. Or on top of that, we just don't have the experience of producing wine at that scale, you know, for that price point. you know, because we are not backed up by the government anyway, like Europe is. You know, there's a lot to be said for that. Is that, hey, yeah, we have to pay a little bit more of a premium for premium wine because we're fronting the entire cost of it. We're not subsidized in any way. So are you going to have to pay more for higher quality American wines? Yes, typically, because that's just, it just costs more for us to make them versus some of our partners, some of our partners across the pond. I forgot what I was trying to say there. Completely fumbled over my words. Ugh. So, you know, this kind of bleeds into question, you know, number three. So let's just roll right into question number three, because these are all kind of like interrelated in a way, in terms of like how they kind of flow, right? So we've got, how can producers entice people to seek out better wine on a more regular basis? And this, you know, and Mike, you use the example, and this is, I'm going to use this as an example because you sent it to me. I'm going to say and preface this with, you know, this is just an opinion. If Josh Sellers gets mad at me, please don't sue me, because they make like 5 million cases a year or something of that wine. It's a different thing. So Mike, you mentioned that you did a tasting comparing Josh with Post Parade, and Anderson's Con Valley over a wide age bracket, and people were really impressed or blown away by the difference between them, specifically saying that they thought they really loved Josh, and this was kind of like their baseline for wines from the sound of it, to like, oh, these other small producers, much smaller producers, like a whole different ballgame. And the question is, okay, how do you get these people to seek out that kind of quote-unquote better wine in their opinion, you know, whether it's dinners, advertising, tastings like this, so on and so forth. So this, you know, tying into like large producers, better quality, and finding some middle ground there, or just trying to entice people to buy what we would consider to be kind of higher quality wines, you got to do the Pepsi challenge. You have to do this. Whether it's through wine dinners, you can't do, like, print advertising, online advertising is not going to do it, because the proof is in the pudding, right? And this is what happens on a regular basis when folks visit Napa or Sonoma, the Willamette Valley, whatever, for the first time. This happens all the time, in that people come out here and they realize that what they've been buying for a great deal in their local grocery store simply does not live up to what is readily available here in the nooks and crannies of the valley, or the Willamette Valley, or certain other insert wine region here, right? So that's the thing, is that you have to get wine in people's glasses, and people have to be willing to kind of branch out. You know, if you love Josh as a wine brand, great, more power to you. If you're wanting to explore, you know, the kind of the craft side of the wine industry and learn, you know, kind of why Josh is the way it is and what goes into making that wine versus, you know, something like a Post Parade or an Anderson's Con Valley, then let's talk about it. You know, the industry as a whole, I think, needs to do a better job of opening this door for people. And we talked, you know, we talked so much about, you know, the additives and residual sugar and stuff like that. You know, the use of Mega Purple within the industry. Go back to our, you know, additives episode from the last couple of years if you want more information on that. You know, that's the kind of stuff that I think we need to kind of shine the spotlight on. You know, and kind of equate it to, you know, here's kind of the fast food of the wine industry versus the like local, like mom and pop, like steakhouse restaurant that you love or whatever. Like there's a difference and there's room for both. But we need to do a better job of kind of bringing people into our world and getting them access to high quality wines. Now, we want to do that. Obviously, if you're talking about Napa specifically, it's tough to get out here. It's a long trip. It's expensive. It's not necessarily in everyone's budget to make this trip happen and come out, even though they might be a big fan of drinking wine on a regular basis. Napa just might not be in the cards for them. So that's why you do see more and more brands, especially right now with a rocky situation that the industry is in. You see more wineries on the road doing more events, and you see them trying to find new customers by asking current customers like, hey, let's do a wine event. Let's do this dinner, or working with a distributor to do a dinner somewhere, whether that's a restaurant or a country club or whatever, and let's introduce more people to more wine. That way, hopefully, you know, maybe they continue drinking Josh, maybe they don't, whatever the case is, hopefully we entice people to drink more wine, or at least wine on a more regular basis versus, say, cocktails or beer, right? That's still kind of, you know, for me personally, the single most like big, like low-hanging fruit that's out there is that wine, and we've mentioned this before on the show, is third fiddle to beer and liquor sales by like a long shot. Like, it's not even close how little wine we drink compared to beer or liquor as a country. It's that is just the honest to goodness truth. And what we, and this is maybe goes back to what I mentioned in, you know, when I was traveling through Missouri and people's opinion of, say, like Napa and some of these big reds is like, oh, it's juicy, it's jammy, it's sweet. Like, there's an air of like, hey, the quality that maybe this region of Napa used to be known for isn't really there as much as it used to be or what we thought it to be. Especially when you can get equivalent styles from a place like Paso or Temecula or whatever. And you're like, oh, this is still juicy and slightly sweet and sexy. And oh, by the way, it's a third or a quarter of the price. So this is where I think Napa in particular, when it comes to like enticing people to seek out, quote, like better wine, has really dropped the ball, is that we jumped on this big, juicy, jammy, high alcoholic, sometimes sweet kind of wine. And the reality is that there's a lot of other producers from a lot of other regions in the U.S. doing just that, and they can do it a lot cheaper than we can. So now you have this issue, and I think this is kind of the tug of war that we as an industry are going to have to deal with, is that when you have kind of the brand of Napa, which has kind of, you know, forever been known for, you know, small production, high quality, and all of a sudden that high quality thing doesn't necessarily make sense, especially for the price, because of the majority of kind of wines that are coming out from here and just kind of the general vibe around it, around the country right now. You know, is Napa going to go away? No, absolutely not. Like, we're going nowhere, right? We'll be around making great wine for a long time, but we have some sorting out to do to entice people to drink these kind of quote unquote better wines, when realistically there's a lot of large producers in Napa that aren't doing that, right? They're making the same kind of sweet, heavily manipulated wines that any other big producer is making. And that's kind of a problem, right? So this is, you know, between, you know, offering this better quality, we hope, you know, from question number two, or kind of trying to get people to seek out better wine on a more regular basis, like, it's gonna be an uphill battle for a little bit, because the general trend of these larger production wines is that the quality, as far as like sweetness and additives and all this other stuff, just isn't there. And also in terms of what you have to pay for it, it's going to be more expensive, because it's just more expensive to produce these wines in the United States versus our European counterparts. So it's a lot easier to find bang for your buck from the EU versus here in the US. So how can we get more people into drinking what we would consider to be higher quality wines from the US? We have to get it into people's glasses. The quality has to match up with the price point, even knowing full well that it's going to be more expensive than, say, a counterpart from Europe. And we're just going to have to hope that people want to buy local. I mean, it's a tall order. And it's a rat's nest of stuff that we got to try and sort through to make that happen. It's messy. It's just messy right now. But the best thing I can say is, for any one of you out there listening to it and you want to try and introduce more people to more good wine, because this is a thing and we talk about this all the time, is we typically save the good wines, quote unquote, for the people that will appreciate them. If you're having a dinner over, you know you have certain friends, I've got certain friends, family, that I don't open certain bottles for. I know you do the same. If you're listening to this, there's a good chance you do the same thing. And maybe it's about time we start opening up some of those really killer bottles for people and comparing them to some of, you know, their normal favorites and saying like, hey, this is the difference between these two wines. Let's do the Pepsi challenge here. And if you still like that cheap and cheerful wine that you like, more power to you. But if you love this really small production, high quality wine, now you know kind of the high watermark. And there's a lot of room to grow within that. That's probably a good way to go about it. All right, we got time for one more quick one. And this is, I think we might have mentioned this previously. I don't know. Did we cover this in another episode? I don't know. I don't think so. Question number four. Can more premium wineries offer second or third labels? Why aren't they doing it now? And Mike, this goes back to another one of your questions, using Bordeaux as an example, coming out with second and third labels to sell wine made from grapes that don't go under the premium label. This is, I mean, look at what Harlan did with the Mascot, right? If you're talking about kind of like a Napa Valley quote, like first growth and kind of that second, I mean, they've got, of course, Bond, the Maiden, Promontory was like the second label, right? And it's still hundreds of dollars a bottle. And now you have the Mascot, which is kind of like more of the young vines and the fruit that kind of gets kicked to the curb, so to speak. Or at least that's what it was. I don't know if they're still doing that. But anyway, it's an offshoot and kind of that second label almost, right? So this is something that's very regular within, again, kind of that European style. Like, hey, there's going to be certain vineyards or certain lots that we just don't use. Let's declassify them and put them into the second or third label. That's something that we're trying to do with our Diversum label, saying, hey, there's going to be certain like barrels specifically within Cabernet that we're just not going to use. So we're not going to sell them on the bulk market because we're going to lose money if we do that. And it's a small enough production that it's not going to break the bank if we bottle it on our own. So let's bottle it on our own and let's try. And yeah, the margins are going to suck, but at least we're making something instead of losing. And let's have the second label do some work for us. Now, the trick, and this is always the concern with a second label, because we talked about this kind of, you know, the high-end quality wine versus the quote-unquote lower-end cheaper wine, right, as far as price point goes, is that if the cheaper wine is good enough, you're not going to convince people to buy the higher-end wine. They might buy a bottle or two of it, but they're not necessarily going to buy that case of it because they're going to backfill with the cheaper stuff. I have a great example of this from my days at Boisset Family Estates because I was hosting a tasting. It was the end of the day. You know, I was selling a bunch of the District Cabernets, kind of the single vineyard cabs, as well as the Generations Cabernet at Raymond, which at the time was like their high end. I think it was like $85 a bottle, maybe $105 a bottle, something like that. And again, this is a long time ago. This is back when this is like 16, 17 years ago. No, 16. Yeah, whatever. It was a long time ago. Decade and a half ago. And there was a certain high-powered individual who sat down at the table and was extolling the virtues of these, you know, who just, and this is what he would do all the time is he would come in and anytime there's someone in the tasting room, we were doing kind of a tasting with folks, he would say hi, shake hands, try and get to know them a little bit, which is something that you don't see that often from, you know, folks of his stature in this industry, but he made a point of it. And, you know, we were talking about the District Cabernets, how good they were, and the Generations Cab and how good it was. And as soon as he said this, I was like, oh, you ruined my sale because I work on commission. He's like, you need to try our Napa Valley Cabernet. And I said, and they're like, yeah, we would love to. And I'm like, oh no. Because now we're trading down to this, like, I think a $45 or $55 bottle of wine versus the, like, $75 to $105. And the second they tried it, they amended their order, which was, like, a mixed case of the higher-end wines, and they replaced six of those with the lower-end cab. And I sat there and was like, you ruined my sale. I was so mad. But that's what can happen. So when the lower, kind of that, what we're saying is that like lower end or more affordable wine is too good, it can certainly cannibalize your sales. You also have to keep in mind that where's the sales outlet for this going to be, right? Because you don't necessarily want to be selling that wine like at the estate, right? You don't want that second label to be like readily available. Maybe it's available for purchase. So if you want to add some on, you're more than welcome to, but you certainly don't taste it there. very typically, this is what we do with our Diversum wine, is that it's available, but you're probably not going to taste it at the winery. We're going to focus on our really high-end stuff that you can typically only find in like our wine club and things of that nature, right? So there is kind of like a separation of church and state that needs to happen between your second, third labels or whatever, and like your main kind of high-end label. And this is what a lot of kind of these first growths or Grand Cru type places have done, is that there's a, number one, there's a clear distinction of quality and style. And then two, you're probably not going to be able to try those what would be considered lower tier wines at that place. They're available. You're not going to be drinking them there, because they want you to focus on the high-end stuff that they want to be selling, because you're going to try and find another sales outlet for something like that. And that's where our Diversum comes into play, is that it's available. You know, if you want to buy it from us, you certainly can, but it's something that we as a producer have specifically made for distribution. We want this to be out in the world to hopefully introduce people into, kind of going back to the last couple of questions, what a high quality wine can be from Napa. Because this is a Napa cab, it's 100% Napa cab actually that we're making. That's $65 a bottle. That's meant to be like available in retail shops and restaurants for a pretty decent price compared to a lot of the counterparts that are in there, given that we had to make it in a very different style to maintain that price point, and my margins are terrible on it. We do not make hardly anything on that wine, but again, it's better than losing money trying to sell stuff on the bulk market, especially right now. You know, it's something that we do 150 cases of. It's not like this giant production. It's only going to end up in a handful of places. You know, could we scale it up? Actually, potentially we could. And we could start making, you know, not just 100 or so cases of it, but a few hundred cases or 1,000 cases of it. We could potentially scale it up. You know, there's kind of a path there that we may explore in the future if it's something that catches on. We'll see. But, you know, the second or third label thing is, especially right now, can be very advantageous. I don't know why more people don't do it. I think there's great success stories. And I think that, unfortunately, there are a lot of people that, you know, kind of just screw it up by, one, presenting it in the wrong places, not having a great sales outlet for it, or three, the wine's just too damn good and it does, in fact, cannibalize your other wines. And that's why you really don't see a lot of premium, I would say, wineries, especially in, you know, California, offering these kind of second, third labels, because they just don't know how to do it, or they've tried and they failed miserably. And it just leaves a bad taste in your mouth, and you don't do that ever again. Yeah, it's an interesting conundrum. You know, I think, man, it's weird. This week's Q&A, I feel like I didn't answer a lot of questions. I feel like there was a lot of ambiguous, like, hey, this is kind of the vibe of what we're thinking or what we're doing or how this operates within the industry. Outside, the first question in like blending was an easy one. Like, okay, we can kind of distill that down to a good answer. But between, you know, questions 2 through 4, you know, trying to find good quality from large producers, trying to entice people to seek out better, higher quality wines. And then also, you know, why aren't these premium wineries that could produce these, quote, better wines, why aren't they? I think that's something that this is all stuff that the industry is like reckoning with right now. It's very, very topical. And man, like, it just, there's gotta be a way to do it. There's gotta be a way to do it. And I hope that more of us kind of figure this out and work together to figure some of this stuff out, because it's feisty. It's just feisty right now. The industry in general. And these are the kinds of questions that are kind of plaguing us right now in terms of like, why can't we, you know, consumers asking us, why can't we find good quality wine in our grocery store, right? How can we encourage producers, big producers, to make higher quality wine? And can some of our favorite small kind of boutique brands make second or third labels that, yeah, are larger production, but, and maybe it's not the highest of quality, but it's good, right? Why can't they do that? These are all very good questions. I wish I had more answers for them. Hopefully some of them made some semblance of sense. But this is a lot of tug of war. All these questions are playing a lot of tug of war in our industry right now. And we're kind of in this weird, like, growing pains kind of situation of figuring out the next steps and what we're going to do from here. All right, we're going to wrap it up there. I appreciate you, Mike. Thank you for always chiming in and dishing out some good ideas, some good questions. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Appreciate you guys. Be sure to like, subscribe, rate, and review the show wherever you're consuming your podcasts. Be sure to follow us on all of our social networks. That's at MTG Wines on YouTube, Instagram, The Book of Face, and the social network formerly known as Twitter. If you want to submit your questions for the next Q&A episode at the end of June, you can do so by sliding into our DMs on any of the social networks or head to our website, mtgawines.com. Scroll down on the homepage. You'll find a little email form you can fill out. While you're there, check out our wines, check out our wine club, sign up for the mailing list, all that good stuff. You can also check out the HBIC's wines at blairpaytonwines.com. Links and all that good stuff will be in the description of the episode here. If you head to our website and are ordering wine, please be 21 years of age or older. That would be much appreciated. Have an excellent rest of your week. Hopefully you all had an amazing Memorial Day weekend, getting a little R&R in. We will see you next week to kick off the month of June here on the Wind Up Podcast. Take it easy. Cheers.